Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Herman and Corin. So I'd like to talk today about a subject that is really, really close to home for me, pun intended. And that is, I think it's worth, there's actually two episodes that we're going to do talking about two aspects of this. And I think we could probably do 20 and only scratch the surface of the topic. But let's start with this one because it's the hardest one. So I grew up in Ireland, in Cork, for those wondering where I'm from originally. And we had a family home, like a detached house that we lived in. And that's what I knew about accommodation. You had a house. It didn't change. And until really I moved to Israel. I moved to Israel about 10 years ago. And since then, it's been a kind of stream of apartments. Now, the reason for this is because my wife and I, despite our best efforts, and some might say perhaps where we're interested in living, but we haven't been able to get on the housing ladder, despite, you know, doing what we'd hoped might get us there, like earning jobs like most people and trying to save like most people. But property just being so astronomically expensive that it's just been out of reach. And we talked about the macroeconomic dimensions of that in a previous podcast. But here's where sometimes I've been thinking about this over the years, and it's a really heavy weight. Sometimes I feel like I'm a failure for not being able to buy property. I see my friends in Ireland where in some parts property is cheaper and being able to, you know, make that step and owning a place. And I wouldn't say it makes me even jealous or envious anymore, except for the stability. When I say that, I've kind of detached myself from the idea, and I think it's really interesting to think about how property ownership is entrenched in kind of a national identity. What I looked at before was, to what extent is property ownership normalized? And what I find, I wouldn't say distasteful, but a bit kind of hard to stomach about society in Israel, is that there is still a very widespread concept that renting is something poor people do. And if you're renting in your 30s, you must have done something wrong. And for a lot of people, especially immigrants who've come to the country after property just skyrocketed, you're not necessarily a poor person. You might have a decent standard of living even, but you just can't gather together the capital for that astronomical purchase. The morbid thought that I've had sometimes, and sorry anyone, this is going to be a bit of a dark one, but when I was trying to reconcile myself to this idea of maybe we can't own, I thought that, do we actually own anything? I mean, when you sort of have the experience of a loved one passing away and seeing their stuff being put into moving boxes or thrown out, you kind of think, well, isn't a house just the same? It's just somewhere you live in. Now, that's not really accurate because we have inheritance and stuff like that, but it's still kind of a temporary thing. And my thought was, well, why don't we just accept that and let's say people rent? Who cares who you rent from? And in your episode about, I asked you how different cultures have approached this. And my thought was that I believe personally that the normalization, when renting is normalized and accepted, a society shifts the way it organizes its affairs in order to create a rental market that actually works for people and is fair. And I asked you guys, well, where is renting normalized, and which jurisdictions have really done a good job at creating proper, decent tenancy codes that provide the incentive, as you mentioned, for landlords to do what they need to do to make it worthwhile, or the state, while also providing a rental market that's not only fair, but I use this term very advisedly, dignified, because I've been in situations where, as a tenant, over and over again, I've been, you know, threatened by landlords for having the temerity to report a hazardous leak that was dripping on our bed and forced us to relocate. I once had, this is the worst story, but it's one that's etched in my memory. So when I moved to Israel 10 years ago, first port of call was in Ulpan, where language learning school I spent. That's usually how people start their time in Israel. Then a couple of sublets. And this world was very foreign to me. As I said, growing up in a single house, I really didn't know what a sublet was. But I got the concept. And those were okay, but, you know, then my first proper rental. Now, I went to work one day, and the neighbors below me, a couple of guys, said there's a leak in our ceiling. And I said, all right. So I got in touch with my landlord, who said they're going to send someone to check upon it. They're going to be there while you're at work. I was working at a startup at the time. I came back, and I have a video of this for those who might doubt the absurdity of this story. It's picked up in a blog, actually, about renting in Israel. I came back to find that my toilet, you know, the thing you use when nature calls, had been extracted from the wall. There was literally an open pipe. And the next day, so that this was the method of investigation. The next day, where the floor was, had been reduced to rubble, literally. There was one of those big jackhammer things. And apparently in the course of diagnosing the leak, it didn't occur to my landlord that you can't just reduce someone's toilet to rubble. So this went on, and over the course of 3 weeks, they eventually reluctantly gave me the key to a spare apartment in the building, so I had somewhere to use a toilet. This leak kept recurring. It turned out that the sublet was legally divided, or the place was legally divided. And the end of the story is that the last leak was essentially a flood. It was literally, you know, a few millimeters of water, bunches of my stuff got ruined. And I had to evacuate. I didn't know what else to do. The contractor they kept bringing in kind of looked at me and said, I would leave. So that was the final push. And I lost my deposit, but I also lost my dignity. I literally had to move all my belongings that were covered in sewer water from what I could understand. And just feeling like this was an atrocious experience. Did I look into litigating it? I guess like most people, I just had so much going on. I was literally my first year in Israel, that and learning the language, the process of taking someone to court for that just seemed so daunting. And I was just happy enough to have a roof over my head again when I got out of that situation. And recently we found ourselves in a kind of similar situation, which is what made me think about this problem today. The roof started leaking and nothing's been done for 2 weeks. It's flooding and the landlord is now just talking about just ending the lease and saying it's somehow our fault for... So I've just had a bunch of atrocious experiences here renting. The fair tenancy law was introduced in order to try to bring some kind of an order to the rental market in Israel, to provide statutes for things like, in this case, mold, which is a common problem in Jerusalem. The landlord has 72 hours to rectify the situation. The problem that I see with these stories of tenants, I don't know if it's fair to call it abuse, maybe it is. I don't think it's just about losing your dignity. I think it's about feeling that you are a vulnerable little person at the mercy of a machine that is heartless, to put it mildly. And, you know, you kind of assume you feel like there must be no recourse, because if landlords actually feared that there was a consequence for their actions, why would they behave like this? I'm pretty good at documenting stuff. I've documented this in previous situations, but no one seems that worried. So this is really my question. I would regard, sometimes there's a disconnect between what legislators hear in, you know, parliamentary meetings and groups and what reality is as ordinary citizens experience it. If my experience is anything to go by, I would regard Israel's attempts to bring fairness and order to the property market as a total failure. I would say it's jungle out there, and I don't see it as the jungle having gotten better than it was at a previous point in time. And to wrap up with my rant a bit, I want to ask you guys, why is it this way? I know that's not an easy question to get to the bottom of, but I'm a big believer that in Israel, is a very small country. We have some things to teach the world, cybersecurity among others, and an awful lot to learn from the world. And I'd love in that vein to hear your experience in other countries that have maybe had similar dynamics and literally and really cleaned up the problem, and why it is that we encounter things like this, whereby countries bring in these codes to try to make it a better experience for renters, but they end up, for whatever reason, just not seemingly making any difference. And maybe the situation isn't as dire as I think it is. Maybe landlords are in, it's kind of a psychological, it's psychological warfare, and in a sense are trying to get us to think that the situation is totally bleak and that we just have to tolerate this or be sued if we, I think that's the worst one, facing lawsuits for reporting unsafe conditions. Is that maybe a game, and how can we as tenants anywhere in the world do everything we can, everything in our power, whether it's documentation, using whatever powers are vested to local authorities to make this a fair experience? Because I really think it's, we talk about the housing crisis, there's a homelessness crisis, and I'm not saying that this is more severe at all than this, but it's a different kind of crisis that hits at a lot of people who, you know, who they're not out on the streets, but they're living in poor conditions, and the permanent fear that they're, you know, they can be kicked out arbitrarily and have to find back into the rental market. It's a real problem. Herman and Corin, let's talk about this rather dismal topic today. Renting law, the fair rental law, and why is renting often such a degrading experience?
You know, Herman, I was walking through the neighborhood yesterday and I saw a pile of furniture on the sidewalk. It was a decent sofa, a couple of chairs, even a desk. And it got me thinking about how often that sight is actually the aftermath of a minor tragedy. Someone's lease ended, or they were forced out, or the apartment became unlivable. It's such a visceral reminder of how precarious our living situations can be. It's not just wood and fabric, it's the physical remains of a home that didn't hold up.
It's the urban cycle of renewal and displacement, Corn, though usually more of the latter. I'm Herman Poppleberry, by the way, for anyone joining us for the first time. And yeah, that precariousness is exactly what our housemate Daniel was getting at in the prompt he sent us this week. He's had some truly harrowing experiences in the rental market, both in Ireland and right here in Jerusalem. He described it as a jungle. And honestly, looking at the state of some of those sidewalk piles, it's hard to disagree.
Daniel's stories are, well, they're intense. He mentioned coming home to find his toilet literally jackhammered out of the floor because of a leak, and then being left without a bathroom for weeks. It's one of those things that sounds like a dark comedy until it's actually happening to you. Then it's just a violation of basic dignity. Imagine coming home from a long day of work and your most basic human needs are blocked by a hole in the concrete and a landlord who won't answer the phone.
Exactly. And the core of his question is something that I think millions of people around the world are asking right now, especially as we start this year of 2026. Why is there such a massive gap between the laws on the books, like the Fair Rental Law here in Israel or the New Residential Tenancies Amendment Act in Ireland, and the actual lived experience of tenants? Why does the rental market feel like a jungle where the biggest predator wins, regardless of what the statute says? We are sitting here on January 14th, 2026, and yet the power dynamic feels like something out of the 19th century.
It's a fascinating, if somewhat depressing, disconnect. We have all these regulations intended to protect people, yet the power dynamic remains so skewed. I want to dig into that today. Why does the law fail in practice? What are other countries doing differently? And honestly, is there any real way for a tenant to fight back when they're up against a landlord who just doesn't care? We need to look at the mechanics of the law, the culture of ownership, and the actual tools for survival.
It's a big topic, but it's one we need to tackle. Especially because, as Daniel pointed out, there's this cultural pressure to own property that makes renting feel like a temporary or even a failed state of existence. That psychological layer adds so much weight to the whole thing. If you feel like a second-class citizen because you rent, you're less likely to demand the rights you actually have.
Let's start with that disconnect. Israel passed the Fair Rental Law in 2017. It was supposed to be a turning point. It defines what an apartment fit for human habitation actually looks like. It mentions things like functioning plumbing, windows, a door that locks, and the absence of life, threatening hazards like mold or faulty wiring. On paper, it sounds great. It even caps security deposits at the lower of one-third of the total rent for the lease term, or 3 months of rent. So why was Daniel's landlord able to leave him with a hole in the floor and a shrug?
Well, the problem with a lot of these laws, and this isn't just an Israeli issue, it's common in Ireland and the United States too, is that they are often self-enforcing. What I mean is, there is no rental police department that goes around inspecting apartments and finding landlords on the spot. If a landlord violates the law, the burden of enforcement falls entirely on the tenant. And while the 2017 law was a start, it had a major flaw: it didn't cap rent increases. Landlords could just wait for the lease to end and then hike the price to push out a troublesome tenant who dared to ask for a working toilet.
Right, and that's the catch-22. If you're a tenant and your landlord is ignoring a leak or threatening you, your primary legal recourse is to take them to court. But if you're in a housing crisis, do you really have the time, the money, or the emotional energy to sue the person who controls your roof? Even with the 2025 updates in Israel, which now require mandatory mediation before you can even go to court, it's a long, exhausting process.
It really is. And let's talk about those 2025 updates for a second, because they show the government is trying, even if the results on the ground are slow. As of last year, eviction rules in Israel became significantly stricter. A landlord can't just decide not to renew your lease for no reason. They have to present a legitimate legal reason, like needing the apartment for a close family member, and they have to provide concrete proof. If they're just trying to swap you for someone who will pay 500 shekels more, that's now much harder to do legally. But again, who is checking? If the tenant doesn't know the law, the landlord still wins.
It's the same story in Ireland, isn't it? Daniel mentioned the pressure there. Ireland just passed the Residential Tenancies Amendment Act of 2025. It extended the rent pressure zones nationwide until February of this year. And starting in March, they're moving to a new system where rent increases are capped at the lower of 2%, or the rate of inflation. They're even bringing back the rolling 6-year security of tenure. On paper, Ireland is trying to end the jungle. But when the vacancy rate is hovering at just 1 or 2%, the law of the jungle often overrides the law of the land.
That vacancy rate is the key, Korn. In Dublin, the average rent for a one-bedroom is now over 1,520 euros. In Tel Aviv, despite the price corrections we saw in 2024 and 25, you're still looking at 60,000 shekels per square meter to buy, which keeps everyone trapped in the rental market. When the vacancy rate is near zero, the market stops being a place of mutual exchange and becomes a hostage situation. If you complain about the mold, the landlord knows there are 50 people behind you who are so desperate they'll live in a swamp just to have a roof.
And that brings us to the cultural aspect Daniel mentioned. In Ireland and Israel, there is this massive, almost existential pressure to own land. In Ireland, it's often tied to the historical trauma of the Great Famine and the struggle against landlordism. Owning your home isn't just a financial goal, it's a mark of being a full citizen, of having security that no one can take away. Renting is seen as paying someone else's mortgage while you remain in a state of permanent instability.
And in Israel, it's similar but with a different flavor. It's about rooting yourself in a land that has been historically contested. There's that Hebrew term, dirat keva, which means a permanent residence. Renting is seen as erai, or temporary. If you're 40 and renting, the societal whisper is that you haven't quite arrived yet. You're still a nomad. This cultural stigma actually feeds the jungle environment. If we view renting as a temporary stage for young people or a fallback for the less fortunate, we don't invest in making the rental market dignified. We treat it like a bus station instead of a home. And you don't expect a bus station to be comfortable.
Exactly. If the goal for everyone is to escape the rental market, then there's very little political will to professionalize it. But look at the contrast in places like Germany or Switzerland. In Switzerland, about 60% of the population rents. It's not a sign of failure, it's a standard lifestyle choice. They've built a system where renting is actually a viable long-term alternative to ownership.
Let's look at those successful models. What is Switzerland or Germany doing that makes renting a dignified experience? I know they have much longer leases, for one. In Germany, the standard lease is indefinite. Once you're in, you have what's called security of tenure. A landlord can't just decide not to renew your lease because they want to hike the rent for a new tenant or because they don't like your face. They can only evict you for very specific reasons, like if you stop paying rent or if they genuinely need the apartment for themselves. And even then, they have to prove it in a way that is much more rigorous than the new Israeli rules.
And that changes the entire power dynamic. If you know you can stay for 20 years, you treat the place like a home. You're willing to invest in it, and more importantly, you're willing to stand up for your rights because you aren't afraid of a retaliatory non-renewal next July. Another brilliant thing they have in Germany is the Mietspiegel, which is a rent index. It's a public record that shows what the average rent is for a specific neighborhood based on the apartment's size, age, and amenities. It prevents the kind of jungle pricing we see where a landlord just picks a number out of thin air because they know someone is desperate.
The Mietspiegel is a game changer. It turns the market from a dark room where the landlord has the only flashlight into a well-lit space where everyone can see the numbers. If the rent is significantly higher than the index, the tenant has a legal basis to challenge it. German cities regularly update these indexes to reflect changing costs, including energy efficiency, but the core protection remains. It's about transparency.
But what about maintenance? That's where Daniel really felt the degrading part of the experience. How do these countries handle a landlord who refuses to fix a leak? In Israel, the law says they have 3 days for urgent repairs. But as Daniel found out, that doesn't mean much if there's no immediate penalty.
They use a mechanism called rent reduction, or Mietminderung. In many European jurisdictions, if there's a defect that reduces the value of the living space, the tenant has a legal right to unilaterally reduce the rent by a certain percentage until it's fixed. If the heater is broken in the winter, you might pay 20% less. If the toilet is unusable, like in Daniel's case, that could be a 100% reduction. You don't have to go to court first, you just notify the landlord and pay less. It puts the financial pressure on the landlord to act quickly. In the jungle market, the landlord has your money and you have the problem. In the German model, if the landlord doesn't fix the problem, they lose the money. It flips the incentive structure completely.
That sounds like common sense, but I can imagine landlords in Israel or Ireland losing their minds at the suggestion. They'd argue that tenants would abuse it, claiming defects just to save money. But there are safeguards, right? You have to provide proof, and if you're wrong, you could be evicted for non-payment. It creates a baseline of accountability, and it's backed by strong tenant unions. This is something we really lack in many places. In Germany, millions of people belong to the Mieterbund, which is a national tenants association. For a small annual fee, you get legal insurance and access to lawyers who specialize in rental law.
So it's not just a lone tenant versus a wealthy property owner. It's a tenant backed by a massive organization with a legal department. That's how you balance the scales. It's a collective response to a systemic problem. And then you have the gold standard, Vienna, Austria. About 43% of the city's population lives in social housing. But it's not social housing in the way many people in Ireland or the United States think of it. It's not just for the very poor. It's high-quality, beautiful architecture, often with pools and parks, and it's available to a wide range of income levels. Vienna has consistently ranked as one of the world's most livable cities, largely because of this house.
I've seen photos of those Viennese complexes, the Gemeindebau. They look better than the luxury apartments being built in Tel Aviv right now. How does that affect the private rental market? If the city offers high-quality, affordable, secure housing to the middle class, private landlords have to actually compete on quality and price to attract tenants. You can't get away with a jungle apartment if there's a dignified public option right down the street. It sets the floor for the entire market.
Exactly. It's a policy choice. We've chosen to treat housing as a high-yield investment vehicle rather than a basic human necessity. When housing is an investment first and a home second, the jungle is an inevitable result because the goal is to maximize profit and minimize cost, which often means skipping maintenance and jacking up the rent. But as we see in Vienna, it doesn't have to be this way. They fund this through a 1% levy on the salaries of every employee in the city. It's a social contract that says everyone deserves a stable home.
Let's pivot to the practical side for a moment. Daniel asked what tenants can actually do right now, in the systems we have, to protect themselves. If you're in an apartment in Jerusalem or Dublin, and the ceiling starts dripping, what's the first move?
Documentation is your absolute best friend. Daniel mentioned he's good at this, and he's right. You need to create a paper trail that is so undeniable that even the most negligent landlord or the most backlogged court can't ignore it. Never just a phone call. If you have a conversation, follow it up with an email. As we discussed on the phone at 2 p.m. today, I am reporting a leak in the bathroom. Take photos, take videos, use a digital timestamp to prove the date. If the landlord doesn't respond, send a registered letter with a return receipt requested. In many legal systems, that's the gold standard of proof that the landlord was officially notified.
And what about the fair rental law here in Israel? Even if it's hard to enforce, it does give tenants some specific rights. For example, if there's an urgent defect like a plumbing failure, the landlord is legally required to fix it within 3 days. If it's not urgent but still a defect, they have 30 days. The law actually says that if the landlord doesn't fix an urgent defect in time, the tenant can fix it themselves and deduct the cost from the rent. But you have to follow the procedure perfectly. You have to give them the notice, wait the 3 days, and then give them a second notice that you are going to fix it yourself.
It's a minefield. If you miss one step, the landlord can claim you're in breach of the contract. That's why the second piece of advice is to find your community. Even if there isn't a massive national union, there are often local tenant advocacy groups. In Ireland, you have Threshold, which provides free, confidential advice and is working tirelessly to prevent homelessness. In Israel, there are organizations like the Fair Housing Center. These groups have seen it all. They know the specific tricks landlords use, and they can tell you exactly which letters to send. Don't try to be a legal hero on your own.
I also think there's a psychological component to this. Landlords often rely on the tenant feeling small and vulnerable. When you start responding with calm, professional, and legally grounded emails, the dynamic shifts. You're signaling that you aren't a victim. You're a party to a contract who knows their rights. It's about projecting competence. Even if you're terrified inside, your correspondence should look like it was written by someone who has a lawyer on speed dial.
And remember the new mandatory mediation in Israel. If you have a dispute, you can now force the landlord into a room with a mediator before it ever gets to a judge. This is often enough to make a negligent landlord realize that you aren't going to just go away. It creates a cost for their negligence. In Ireland, the Residential Tenancies Board, or RTB, provides a similar service. It's not perfect, and there's often a backlog, but it's a tool you should use.
But let's be real, Herman. Sometimes, the jungle is just too dangerous. Daniel mentioned being threatened. If a landlord is threatening a tenant, that's no longer a civil dispute. That's a police matter. And while the police are often reluctant to get involved, telling you it's a civil matter, having a record of those threats is crucial. In Israel, it's legal to record a conversation as long as one of the parties, which is you, knows it's being recorded. If a landlord says, "If you report this mold, I'll kick you out tomorrow," having that on tape is incredibly powerful.
It's a sad state of affairs when you have to go through life like a private investigator just to have a functioning bathroom. It really speaks to the degrading part of Daniel's prompt. You're being forced to act like an adversary in your own home, which is supposed to be your sanctuary. The home is the foundation of our mental health. If that foundation is unstable, everything else in your life, your work, your relationships, your sense of self, starts to crack. The stress of a bad rental situation is a second-order effect that economists rarely measure, but it's a massive drag on society.
Think about the lost productivity. Think about the kids growing up with chronic respiratory issues because of mold that a landlord refused to clean. Think about the elderly people who are too afraid to complain about a broken lift and end up trapped in their apartments. This isn't just about annoying leaks, it's a public health and human rights issue. In 2026, we should be past the point where a hole in the floor is an acceptable living condition.
You know, there's a concept in urban planning called housing first. It's usually applied to homelessness, the idea that you can't solve someone's other problems until they have a stable place to live. But I think we should apply it to the middle class too. Dignified housing first. If we want a functioning, healthy society, we have to ensure that the place where people sleep is safe and secure. We need to move away from the jungle by professionalizing the industry. In some countries, you have to be a licensed property manager to rent out an apartment. You have to prove you understand the laws and that you have the capital to maintain the property.
It's the mom-and-pop landlord myth. We have this idea that most landlords are just lovely people renting out a spare room to pay their mortgage. And while those people exist, the market is increasingly dominated by professional investors and corporations who use that mom-and-pop image as a shield against regulation. And even the real mom-and-pop landlords can be the worst offenders because they often don't have the cash flow to handle major repairs. They see the rent as pure income, and when the roof starts leaking, they panic and lash out at the tenant because they can't afford the $5,000 repair bill. In a professionalized market, a landlord would be required to have a reserve fund for maintenance.
It's about shifting the risk. Right now, the tenant carries all the risk. If the apartment becomes unlivable, the tenant is the one who suffers. The landlord still has the asset, which is probably appreciating in value anyway. A fair market would distribute that risk more evenly. If we actually made renting dignified, would that cultural pressure to buy ease? Or is the desire to own something innate?
I think it's a bit of both. There is a deep human desire for agency, to be able to paint your walls whatever color you want, and to know you won't be moved. But a lot of the pressure to buy is actually just a rational response to a broken rental market. If renting is a jungle, then buying is the only way to get to the clearing. If the rental market was a manicured park, fewer people would feel the desperate need to buy a plot of land just to feel safe. In Germany, people don't feel that same failure if they rent because they have the same agency. They can stay for 30 years. They can install their own kitchens. They have the security that ownership usually provides without the massive debt.
It also makes the economy more flexible. If people aren't tied to a 30-year mortgage, they can move more easily for better jobs. They can take risks. A healthy rental market is actually a huge economic engine. So, to summarize our jungle survival guide for Daniel and everyone else, document everything like you're a forensic scientist. Find your tribe and tenant unions and advocacy groups. Use the laws that exist, however flawed they are, to create a cost for the landlord's negligence. And psychologically, remember that you are a customer and a contract holder, not a beggar.
And on a systemic level, we need to push for professionalization, for rent indexes, and for a massive increase in the supply of high-quality non-profit or social housing to provide real competition. We have to stop treating the jungle as an act of God and start seeing it as a failure of policy. I'm really glad Daniel sent this in. It's one of those topics that feels so personal and private, but it's actually one of the most universal experiences of modern life. We spend so much of our time inside these four walls. We should probably make sure they aren't crumbling around us.
Well said! And hey, if you're out there listening and you've got your own rental jungle story, or maybe you live in a place where it actually works well, we'd love to hear about it. It helps us build a better picture of what's possible. We appreciate all of you who have been with us throughout our journey. It's been quite a ride from our house in Jerusalem to yours.
Thanks again to Daniel for the prompt. We'll have to see if we can help him with that leak next time it rains.
I'll bring the buckets, you bring the legal code.
Deal. Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. You can find us on Spotify and at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We've got the full archive there if you want to dive into some of our older stuff.
Until next time, stay safe, keep documenting, and don't let the jungle get you down. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
And I'm Corn. See you in the next one.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.